It's usually the mark of a moron who will try and isolate a component of a complex system and try and, you know, attack that. This is, again, that's synonymous with how central banks work. It's synonymous with how governments work. It's synonymous with how pharmaceuticals work. It's synonymous with all of that shit. They think you can isolate components of a complex system and address those in isolation to everything else. And then they wonder why they create 10 problems for every one problem they solve.
Hello, everyone. I'm John Chenot, and welcome to episode 4 of the Bitcoin Path podcast. This is a show where we have casual, deeper conversations about Bitcoin and self-sovereignty, and about how this new magic internet money is changing the world and changing ourselves at the same time. I'm thrilled to have Alex Svetsky on the pod today. Alex is the CEO of Amber App, educator at the Bitcoin Times. He is a passionate author and educator about Bitcoin, money, philosophy, business, startups, and entrepreneurship. You can learn more about what he's up to at his Medium page, svetsky.medium.com, and on Twitter at Alex Svetsky, and those will be in the show notes. We have a truly fascinating discussion about numerous things. But just as a preview, we talk about the relentless pursuit of truth and how Alex sees that as an essential part of navigating this weird, chaotic world that we find ourselves in. We talk about the danger and idiocy of isolating one aspect of a complicated system and how that's so prevalent in most of the solutions that people are relying on today. We talk about the large tech monopolies and how they actually come into existence. Talk about the opportunities that failed states leave for future wealthy Bitcoin entrepreneurs. And along those lines, what role private cities could play as the nation states continue to collapse under their own weight. Pretty intense conversation, okay? I hope you like it. I hope you enjoy it. I had a blast talking to Alex. I hope you enjoy listening in. But before we dive into the conversation, I do want to take a moment and talk about an online event that's coming up December 12th and 13th. An essential part of anyone's Bitcoin journey is putting in the mental work and the time that it takes to understand it from first principles. And depending on your background, this process can take a lot of time. With Bitcoin's inevitable price increase, it makes the amount of time that goes by while you spend time trying to understand it and get your head around it makes the opportunity cost of that time extremely high because things are changing so quickly. That's why I'm hosting an intensive educational event where I'm gathering 6 of the best educators in the Bitcoin community for an immersive online Bitcoin conference. That's December 12th and 13th, and I'm calling it an interactive deep dive. The speakers are Robert Breedlove, Max Hillebrand, Eric Kaysen, John Vallis, Dan Held, and Gigi. There is limited seating, so be sure to register if you haven't already at interactivedeepdive.com, and I really hope to see you there. It's going to be an awesome event. But with that, I hope you enjoy this conversation with Alex Svetsky. Alex, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on, man.
Thanks for being here. One of the things that I wanted to dive right into is this is sort of a setup for people who are very interested in Bitcoin, but are kind of still just entering in and haven't quite gotten a full understanding of the significance of Bitcoin, or you know, they're just kind of like dabbling, I guess. Mm-hmm. So for you, what drew you to Bitcoin in the beginning?
I mean, I've got this meme that I used to sort of like mention all the time, and I think it's even in one of my articles. It's I came for the money and I stayed for the money. So I originally like was looking to just make some cash. Like I'd had a bad experience with a prior business of mine, and I was looking at where to put my time and energy next. And, I'd heard about Bitcoin years prior. I wrote it off as, internet funny money. And I saw it again in 2016. I was like, Jesus Christ, this thing is 10x or 100x of what I saw it last time. And I started digging into it. I bought a little bit. And this is why I always say, you know, there's nothing like a little bit of skin in the game to really, to get you, you know, involved in something or to give you the incentive to actually learn about it. So once I bought a little bit, that really started my journey, you know, down the proverbial rabbit hole to start learning more. But yeah, the original motivation was not, I mean, I don't know these days if there's more people coming into it for more, you know, grandiose kind of reasons or more like change the world kind of reasons. But, mm-hmm. you know, back in 2016, I mean, you know, we didn't have the hysteria and the madness that we're sort of seeing in the world today with, like, you know, fraudulent elections and fraudulent viruses and fraudulent lockdowns and all the other insanity that's kind of like this year's sort of been like, you know, peak stupidity. And, you know, I think there might be slightly different reasons for people coming into Bitcoin at this stage. But back in 2016, for me, the motivator was I thought I found a new vehicle to make money. And originally I got into Bitcoin to make dollars. And that's definitely, you know, the other way around now.
Yeah, that's interesting how it changes. Like your understanding of money, what your understanding was at that time was US dollars.
My understanding, like I was a gold bug for a while though. That's the thing. So I sort of got into the gold and silver space in 2011, 2012. So I've been a gold bug for ages. So I already got all that. The thing is, I didn't associate Bitcoin with any of that because I wasn't on Twitter. I was never on Reddit. Like this is why I love the Bitcoin Twitter community so much is that sort of community is such a, you know, if people enter into Bitcoin and they come into contact with that Bitcoin Twitter community, they'll get sucked in. And Michael Saylor, for example, is a perfect example. And back in 2016, there was no content. You know, you didn't have like, you know, me writing content or Breedlove or Gigi or Connor Brown or, I mean, Nick Carter had probably written a few things, but, you know, it wasn't really popular. You know, the only person who talked any sense back then was Andreas Antonopoulos, and he's kind of lost his mind now. You know, he's become a complete, you know, leftist SJW, you know, shitcoin shill. So it's like it's embarrassing. But I mean, back then the quality of content and the quality of thought just wasn't really there. Like, you know, if I sort of go back to thinking about what were the early articles. It was really like Goldstein and Pierre Rochard, like, you know, that everyone's a scammer article was really prophetic, like that kind of stuff. But it was really, there wasn't much of it around, man. And, you know, so I think the motivations, you know, in that period were definitely different. And for me, it was only when, and again, like, despite me, you know, bagging out Andreas Antonopoulos at this point in time, like, he actually did help me view Bitcoin through a broader lens early on, because, you know, he did kind of talk about it from an evolutionary perspective. He did talk about it from a, you know, perspective of enabling censorship resistance and freedom of speech and all these sorts of things, which I naturally aligned with, being a quasi libertarian. Like, again, I also wasn't really down the rabbit hole of libertarianism and all that sort of stuff, but being an entrepreneur, being someone who was self-made, I was already primed for that kind of thinking, you know, for personal responsibility. Like I had already, you know, self-indoctrinated myself in, you know, philosophies and theories and psychology of personal responsibility. And I also understood how, you know, QE worked and money printing worked. And, you know, I held gold, I held silver and all this sort of stuff. So I had those ingredients there. And Andreas was the first, you know, piece of the puzzle for me that helped start to bring things together. And then as I dug more, then, hey, you know, I wrote my first big piece, which was, I think it was called Homo Sapiens, Evolution and Money. And that was sort of partly inspired by that book, Sapiens by Yuval Harari, who I think that book was okay, but, the more mature I've become, the more I realize that Harari is just another, you know, very conventional thinker, you know, with very few original ideas. But
yeah,
you
the
know,
book
again,
was fascinating because it did. I get that too, but it opened my mind to, like, before I read that, I never even realized that there were more, there were different types of sapiens. Like, I thought that the Neanderthals were just like an iteration of Homo sapiens. I never realized that they were like all living together at the same time in a lot of ways.
Anthropology is such a powerful subject. It's such a powerful subject. And credit where credit's due, Harari was able to take, you know, what's traditionally been quite a esoteric subject. Most people don't even know what the word anthropology means. And he put it into a book. He made it very readable. He made the core insights of anthropology, you know, quite accessible. And for me, like, that was a really powerful book. So I read that around the same time as I started reading Taleb's work. And those two really sort of ignited, like, I read those around the time when I was, you know, going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, and that all sort of culminated together for me. And you know, again, I believe now along the journey, I found much more credible works, much more powerful works, like, you know, works from Hans Hermann Hoppe, from Murray Rothbard, like that. Those guys are the true giants, like, you know, people like Harari pale in comparison to these thinkers. But along the way, it was good to sort of find that stuff. And I was able to, you know, understand Bitcoin through a more anthropological context, through a context of skin in the game. And, you know, then I think at some point in time, I read Seyfertin's Bitcoin Standard, which was, you know, again, having had a background, I was already a Bitcoin maxi by then, but you know, that sort of like really tied it off for me. The rest is history. So like it was just fascinating for me to find, because you know, in the beginning, again, because I wasn't a complete Bitcoiner or a Bitcoin maxi, because I came in at 2016, I got sucked into the whole the ICO craze and the shit coining and the Ethereum. And I thought there was something there. I mean, I even went to the expense of buying all these stupid, you know, GPUs and, you know, mining upstairs at my place and all this kind of garbage. When I think back about the amount of money, time and energy that I wasted on that stupidity, it's embarrassing. Like it's absolutely embarrassing. And for me, I still like, you know, I think a couple of the things that, like, cause I've always been, you know, quite, I guess I was, you know, maybe lucky, or maybe just my background in math and engineering, you know, which are real, like, they're actual sciences. you know, they force you to think critically. And you know, you don't accept opinions at face value. So I had a natural tendency to be a little bit more critical in my thinking, and probably also inspired by my uncle, who was a bit of a critical thinker. So that, you know, luckily wasn't beaten out of me completely during, you know, the state indoctrination that is schooling. So, you know, when I was coming across, you know, Bitcoin content and, you know, understanding how Bitcoin functions, that was really like, I was not finding any bullshit there. But, you know, when I was sort of looking into the crypto stuff and into the blockchain garbage, like, I remember at one point I was even running little courses where I was teaching people, you know, what is blockchain? And I mean, I got confused myself as I started describing how distributed ledger technology and blockchain works, but in the absence of proof of work. And I, like, after running a couple of the classes, I was like, what in the name of Christ am I talking about here? Like, I'm actually bullshitting these people. So, you know, I through like rigor and through poking holes into the, you know, the whole shitcoin crypto and blockchain crap, realized that that was all stupidity. And that's sort of what helped, you know, also I think helped me converge onto Bitcoin. And I still remember we had a little crypto group in Brisbane, and I became the first toxic Bitcoiner. And this was sort of before I was on Twitter. So this is why, again, I love the whole toxic Bitcoin sort of space on Twitter, is like, I've kind of found my family, because I was like that already. And I started like, you know, bagging out these shit coiners and all this sort of stuff. And then I, you know, accidentally found Twitter. And, you know, one thing led to another. I was like, oh, holy crap. Like, you know, this is sort of my crew. So it's, you know, to me, it's just validation of, you know, being a rational, deep thinker who's actually critical, in the truest sense of the word. And, you know, it's, that's the kind of people who end up becoming, you know, quote unquote, Bitcoin maximalist or supremacist or whatever the fuck label people want to give us these days.
Right.
Which I'm happy to accept.
Yeah. That's huge. Alex, dude, I commend you on that journey of just like going so far into some of these deviating paths, so to speak, and then just kind of recognizing where you went wrong and kind of recorrecting. I think that takes a lot of self-awareness. And sometimes I sense for myself, I can be overly concerned about like being wrong about something or trying to saying the right thing or going the right direction. But there's this openness that I feel like as long as you have this openness to being wrong and correcting your path, that helps you find the proper way.
It's true. I think you need to have a relentless, you know, you need to be relentless in your pursuit of the truth. And, you know, in being relentless in that pursuit, you're going to have to burn things, to the ground behind you in the sense of, and I don't mean burning other people's things to the ground. I mean, burning things to the ground that you thought personally were true. And, you know, like, so I, you know, I thought Ethereum was Bitcoin 2.0 in the beginning. And, you know, as I was, you know, journeying on my relentless pursuit of truth, I discovered that that was not true. And, you know, I moved away from that. And like, you know, I in the beginning revered like, you know, Vitalik, because I thought it was, you know, such a genius, because, you know, he would talk about shit that I couldn't understand and I felt stupid. But as I understood more, I realized that fuck, this guy's just talking shit. And I realized that, you know, and the more I looked at, you know, the charlatans of the world, whether it's, you know, from the Theranos to the, you know, Madoffs to any other scammer that's ever existed, you know, the P.T. Barnum sort of type scammer, it's you talk to people in a way that doesn't make sense and that sounds fucking smart. And you can pull the wool over their eyes very easily. It's the classic snake oil salesman. And the thing is, the only way to be immune from that, to protect yourself from that as an individual, is to continue to devour knowledge, is to continue to be relentless in your pursuit of truth, and to call out the bullshit when you see it. And I think that, like, I mean, this is where I give a lot of credit to someone like Nassim Taleb. Like, you know, I lost a lot of respect for him this year because of, you know, his sort of pro-mask position and his, you know, his little rampage that he had against Bitcoiners and stuff like that. But other than that, like, he's been one of those relentless, people in a relentless pursuit of truth. Like, his work I really resonated with, because he does point out, you know, the fools of randomness and how, you know, fragility builds through, you know, personal biases and all that sort of stuff. So he does make you check yourself, and, you know, really, really dig deeper than just, you know, what might seem nice on the surface, but, you know, may have second, third, fourth order consequences, beyond that, that are contrary to what, you know, you purport to believe. And that's again, like, that kind of depth is really rare in the world now, man. Like, you have all these idiots running around, you know, who are like brave enough to say, I stand against poverty. It's like, congratulations, moron. Like, who doesn't, you idiot? It's like, you know, there's just this crazy shallowness that we're all drowning in the world, because people refuse to, you know, to think deep, because it's hard. But, you know, that's, again, being a Bitcoiner forces you to really, really think deep. And that's why there's so few of us at this point in time.
Yeah. That's, I find it fascinating that, like, it's something that really deals with these massive problems, like, on a grand scale, Bitcoin is. And we do talk about really big ideas, right? But what's drawn me to the community and what I've really appreciated about it is just the ability to slowly build an understanding of of what's going on based on first principles and understand what these giant, you know, macro trends are doing, but then also recognize what it means on a very practical, personal level for your individual action. It seems like there's just a strong connection there. That's one of the things that really differentiates the Bitcoin community to me. It's interesting.
It does. It's actually extremely refreshing for me. And I mean, look, it's not across the entire Bitcoin community. Like I've, you know, lost a lot of respect for a lot of so-called Bitcoiners who are, who just buy into stupid shit, just because it's politically correct, you know, which to me is incredibly ridiculous. But I mean, that aside, most Bitcoiners who've really, 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 really thought about it and who really, really, really grasp the nature of Bitcoin, you know, they get it. They have been forced to become critical thinkers. And like you said, they don't just sort of buy into these platitudes that sound nice, but that have no basis in reality. You know, that they kind of come to terms with the reality of the fact. Like, I mean, Bitcoin is one of these things that it is this living, breathing set of trade-offs. You know, people talk about, you know, this idea of scalability, you know, and they try and talk about scalability in this single dimension. And it's not. Scalability is a multidimensional concept, which, you know, for example, if you look at it narrowly, you know, without regard to all of the other elements of scalability, if you say, oh yeah, Bitcoin transactions are slow because, you know, 10 minute blocks and blah, 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 you miss out on, you know, what about the scalability of its censorship resistance? What about its scalability of node operators? What about its scalability for cheap verification? So it's like, you know, morons. So generally the how you notice a moron is someone who thinks that you can take one element from a complex system and make judgments on it without regard to all of the other elements. And I spoke about this in the talk that I did, which was Blockchain is Dead, The Future is on Bitcoin or Future is on Lightning. And I sort of discussed this notion of, you know, blockchainers are these people. Is they talk about blockchains as some sort of new decentralized paradigm and all this shit, but then they sort of do away with proof of work, which is one of the core ingredients for ensuring you have consensus amongst parties who are distributed around the world who may or may not know each other. Like, right. So it's like they want a cake, but so I call it the cake analogy, which is they're like, okay, we're gonna make you a better cake, but the, you know, we're not gonna bother with flour or sugar or you know, or chocolate or any of the other ingredients. We're just gonna scramble some fucking eggs, and they're gonna sell it to you as a cake. It's not the same thing. So this is, again, it's usually the mark of a moron who will try and isolate a component of a complex system and try and, you know, attack that. This is, again, that's synonymous with how central banks work. It's synonymous with how governments work. It's synonymous with how pharmaceuticals work. It's synonymous with all of that shit. They think you can isolate components of a complex system and address those in isolation to everything else. And then they wonder why they create 10 problems for every one problem they solve. And that's the definition of shallow thinking. That is the lack of courage to realize that everything, every action you make in this complex world has a set of, you know, reactions. They're all interdependent in some way. So everything is a trade-off. There is no action without a trade-off. So, you know, Bitcoiners understand, you know, and particularly as they understand Bitcoin better, they understand Bitcoin's got these set of trade-offs that it's made in order to deliver maximum censorship resistant, in order to deliver maximum decentralization, so that we can have a base, you know, network or a base money that is unconfiscatable, you know, uninflatable and incorruptible. And guess what? The problems that are associated with that, you know, are, you know, limited scalability in terms of base layer throughput. We will solve them, you know, in another way, you know, i.e. a second layer or a third layer or something like that. This is what idiots like the Bcashers or morons like the Ethereans or other blockchainers who think about enterprise blockchain or you know, leftists with their agenda, they all have that same common theme. They don't understand trade-offs, and you know, they don't understand the constraints that we live in a real physical world that has limited resources, that has limited time, and that, you know, exists in the bounds of, you know, uncertainty. Their realities that they refuse to seem to want to acknowledge.
Yeah. And given that we've lived in a society, or we currently live in a society now, or a world in which large institutions have been operating off of this moronic frame of mind, right, that you describe, for a long time, right? Like, I look around and I see complete nonsense everywhere. And it's almost overwhelming to the point where, like, where do you even start in terms of addressing some of these major problems? What are kind of the main problems that you see that should be taking precedence in our minds as we, like, as entrepreneurs, we're looking at the world, we want to solve problems and help people. Where are you being attracted?
As entrepreneurs who want to solve problems, you mean, or in what context?
Well, I guess kind of bringing it back to Bitcoin, how do you see Bitcoin interacting with the world right now?
Did you get a chance to read that Bitcoin and Lockdowns article that I wrote?
I did. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So I think, you know, for those who are listening and want to read the article, go read the article. It's probably better described or better explained there than I'll be able to do over a podcast, you know, off the top of my head. But let's sort of dig into a couple of things. So there's no silver bullet to any of the challenges that we're facing today. You know, and this is sort of the beauty of a free market, is that, you know, problems are all interrelated in some way. That, you know, and there's correlation between all sorts of different things in the world. And trying again, the fallacy of the central planners and the people who believe that all problems can be solved, you know, if the academic intelligentsia apparently has all the power. You know, the fallacy that they have, or that they fail to comprehend, is that because in a complex world that is, you know, broadly diverse, you know, problems are generally not only subjective, but they're just so varied across so many different places and times and contexts that, you know, one thing can never solve a problem for everything. Like, that's impossible. So what we have is, you know, we have to have this almost like a multi-pronged approach, which, you know, over time needs to, you know, solve, you know, different problems. And you know, again, with problems, when you solve one problem, you know, when you know you've solved the problem well, when you have a new, better quality of problem. It's not that you have no more problems. And again, I think that's a really important point, because if you have no more problems, you're dead. You know, you cease to exist. Like, life is this constant evolutionary process of solving problems and dealing with a better quality of problem. You know, so if you solve you know, some level of base poverty, you know, the next quality of problem is, how do you solve for, you know, more food, or how do you solve for more economic infrastructure? So the quality of problem needs to improve. So, you know, where we are now with, like, lies and deceit and, you know, centralization and, you know, the creation of monopolies that have emerged because of the monopoly of the state and the monopoly of the central banks, you know, what, you know, we need to be looking at, like, how do we, you know, get our money out of the, you know, the central bank monopoly. Like, that's one thing. You know, then how do we get decision making outside of the monopoly of the government? How do we get you know, the monopoly of violence away from the monopoly of government? You know, how do we get the monopoly of communication away from, you know, the social media giants? You know, how do we get the monopoly of, you know, transmission of media and of ideas away from the Netflixes or the mainstream medias of the world? So, I mean, I don't have all those solutions. If I did, I'd be a trillionaire. So again, this is the beauty of the free market, is that we'll, You know, people will come up with solutions, but I think, you know, what it does need to start with is this this kind of commitment in the beginning to, again, a relentless pursuit of objective truth. It's got to come from a place of courage as opposed to a place of, you know, just fucking vanilla acceptance of, you know, what is nice. It's got to come from a place of, you know, wanting to be a contrarian, you know, and it's got to come from a place of, you know, the ability to disobey and the ability to question authority, which I think is also something that's being stamped out by mainstream media, by social media, by government, by central banks. Is, you know, you're no longer allowed to have an opinion that's contrary to what the status quo apparently, you know, dictates is truth, right? So, you know, we've got these fucking truth police and thought police that are running around telling us what to think. So it's got to be, you know, it can't be a concerted effort. Like, it can't be this coordinated effort, because, you know, free markets are not, by definition, they don't need to be coordinated. They just sort of need to happen and emerge naturally. So, you know, I think there's going to be huge potential for people to build, like, you know, modern communication products that are, you know, end-to-end encrypted, for example, that you know, do, they might charge, instead of being like free like WhatsApp, they might just charge $10 a year, but you get a guarantee of, you know, end-to-end encryption, you know, maybe based on some sort of open source, you know, encryption software that you pay a small subscription fee for. And these businesses will move away from, you know, funding themselves via, you know, propaganda, i.e. advertising.
Aggregating data and selling.
Yeah, exactly.
Selling identities. Like, and
exactly. So there'll be market forces that drive the emergence of these new kind of companies. And that's where I think the future potential is like, you know, companies that give a guarantee that, hey, we don't care who you are. You know, you can be anonymous and you can use our software, you can use our product, but hey, there's a fee. Again, what's crucial to think products like this actually being enabled is the existence of a money that doesn't care who you are. So this is why, you know, Bitcoin is just so central to a lot of it, is that all of this stuff can emerge, like the notion of micropayments as well, like the ability to if you want to have a feed, like a social media feed, but without having any fucking advertisements, you can plug in your Lightning wallet, for example. And again, this is just me, you know, making up ideas, but you plug in your Lightning wallet and, you know, as you scroll and, you know, see things in your feed, you know, you don't have to see any advertising, you don't have to see shit, you can just see what's important to you, but the usage is sort of paid for in sats, maybe one sat per hour or something like that, you know what I mean? And those kind of things will be able to emerge because Bitcoin transforms the very notion of money. You know, it removes the need for identity and it removes the need to be dependent upon a third party payments provider that sits in the middle who cannot make it economically feasible to do sort of micropayment type things. So I think, you know, that's sort of, you know, Bitcoin's going to enable a whole new suite of, you know, communication media, you know, journalism, you know, video media, all this sort of stuff that was traditionally, you know, monetized out the back end through the sale of data and through advertising. That's going to be really, really interesting. Like me, if I was an investor, if I was like a, you know, VC, like that's where I'd be looking for the next big companies, because they're the ones who are going, like, you know, all this suppression of speech, all that sort of stuff that's happened, particularly this year, those people want to go somewhere where they're not going to be censored and they're all going to be willing to pay $10 a year or whatever, you know, amount that allows them to build their own communities that are not going to be censored. And that's how we fucking take the power back, by building shit that, you know, circumvents these clowns that think they can play God with everyone.
100%. I wholeheartedly agree, man. And what's interesting is, as I've thought about the all this censorship that's been going on, there are so many industries and or groups of people, right, on YouTube and on Twitter, these platforms that have kind of, it's almost like they've been whittling down the amount of the types of people they allow to be promoted and this kind of thing. And what's interesting is a lot of that is coming from the banking forces and the financial incentives, right, where banks are limiting these technology companies' financial services based on the type of content that they provide. So I just wonder, this is kind of like an aside, but I wonder, you know, how mad we get at like Twitter or YouTube and everything. You know, they're just the front of it, where maybe there are other incentives that are making them do these things. Do you see that as an issue?
Look, I mean, again, all these problems are complex, so they're not you know, unidimensional. They're multidimensional. So you've got a situation where,
right,
you know, the state has, you know, mandated all these kind of stupid regulations to say that you guys must now, you know, ensure that there's no hate speech on your platform. It's like, well, fucking hell, like, how do we now define what hate speech is? And then, you know, so then of course these corporations are going to sort of err on the side of, you know, safety, because they don't want to cop a $1 billion fine because, you know, someone said something like fucking hail Hitler on, you know, on their platform. So it's like, it's, right, you know, so, you know, granted it's not easy, but, you know, then you have the problem of, okay, they err on the side of safety, but that, you know, these departments that, you know, are probably hired to moderate free speech, you know, the kind of idiot that's going to apply for that kind of job is someone who doesn't believe in free speech, or who believes their speech is more important than others, which is naturally going to be the kind of SJW fucking leftist moron who, you know, thinks in unidimensional terms, right, and is going to go around thinking that it's okay to cancel. So that the problem kind of, you know, compounds on itself. So I guess this is where the notion of the Streisand effect comes into place. You know, you suppress something and then you actually make it, you know, more known in the process of suppressing it. And that's kind of the natural function of capitalism innovation, is that, you know, as a monopolist of some sort, you know, as their product or service gets worse, you know, the incentive to compete or to go on, you know, build something better than they have done increases. And mm-hmm. I mean, it's become a lot harder. I'm just about to publish an article, you know, shortly, which is which kind of touches on this idea of monopolies breed more monopolies. And the idea is that the government and central banks, because, you know, they've made themselves a monopoly on the issuance of money, and a monopoly on the dictates of morality and ethics via law. So what they've done is they've created all this regulatory fucking nonsense in the way of, you know, free individuals being able to voluntarily trade. What they've done is they've actually made way for the emergence of these monopolies. And then people who, again, don't think deeply, you know, the SJWs, the lefties, the commies, all these dumbasses who think that capital, you know, they sort of say that capitalism is the problem. But, you know, capitalism has nothing to do with government regulation or with central bank fucking money printing. So it's not capitalism. The problem is that all this, you know, these regulations, the way they end up working is that they limit new entrants. So they actually limit free market competition, and all the money printing ends up exaggerating the natural Pareto law kind of distributions that happen in a free market. Because, you know, all of the money that gets printed disproportionately goes to, you know, either A, the better producers. So, you know, you could sort of count Amazon and the Googles and all that sort of stuff in that, or B, the ones who have the, you know, the regulatory moat, like your Pfizer's or your, you know, your big farmers and all that sort of kind of companies. So they end up getting mm-hmm. all the money that is printed. So then they have all the fucking money to, you know, if a competitor comes up, what do? They buy them out before they become any, you know, threat. So you actually create these behemoths, these monopolies, because they sort of coalesce, they congregate around the pre-existing monopolies, which is the regulator, i.e. the government, and the money printer, i.e. the central bank. So that they've kind of, right, spawned their own problem. And in the process, it's kind of like, you know, poetic justice in a way. They're going to make themselves obsolete by, you know, what I call the next, you know, the sort of the nation state made the church obsolete. But mm-hmm. you know, the nation state and central bank are going to make themselves obsolete because they've spawned a new monster, which is the technocratic order, which is these, you know, these companies now that are so large that they basically dictate what we think, eat, sleep, hear, and like, you know, that they have more power over that shit than the government could have ever hoped to have. So, it's a really interesting, interesting period, but you know, again,
yeah, thanks, scares the shit out of me.
It's fucked up, but thank fuck we have Bitcoin, right? Thank fuck we have Bitcoin, because you know, Bitcoin's sort of this this balance, this countermeasure to that centralization of power, and you know, it'll give us an ability to do things. I mean, maybe the one lucky element of you know, the technocratic order might be that, you know, they, you know, there's a chance they're more economically inclined to a degree, but then again, I mean, I guess so are the central banks and governments, because you know, they're parasitic in nature to give themselves an economic advantage over others. So I don't know, it's you know, it's kind of like a new Leviathan, and you know, it was the old Leviathan that spawned this one, so it's like fucking hell, you know.
That's just the Hydra, right?
You cut, exactly, yeah.
You cut off one head and respawns. Well,
this one's like a retarded Hydra because it cut off its own fucking head. and, you know, it's made more. So it's like morons, you know what I mean? They'll blame, you know, entrepreneurs for bringing down the government or for not wanting to pay taxes anymore. You know, they'll blame the people when it's their own stupidity that, you know, made them obsolete.
Right. I think this is a good time to kind of like take our projection a little more into the future. And one of the things, like, regardless of how dystopian all of this shit seems with the growing surveillance state, the companies that are just capturing pretty much everything we're doing and saying online, keeping it in a database or whatever, what excites me is the power of the Bitcoin network itself, and also just all of the individuals that are participating in it and contributing. And like you were talking about how just a couple years ago, you were trying to learn about Bitcoin, but you didn't really have the amount of resources, near quality and amounts of resources that are out there now. And it's so cool to see, you know, to have friends who are coming and asking me about it and just having so many options to like share with them. I'm like, yeah, just, you know, go check out this podcast, a couple of these short articles that really dial things down in a first principles way. The knowledge, information is just so, is able to be transmitted so easily. So that's what's exciting about the Bitcoin network. There are still concerns around physical space that I have, where as much as we can protect our information, we're still in this realm where if we want to live freely, we need to be able to travel. We need to be able to move from place to place and just have general security in around our physical bodies. So I was wondering, you know, you mentioned your interest in potentially getting involved in private cities in the future. Mm-hmm. And that to me is a really fascinating concept that I'd love to dive into. Like, how do you see that developing?
Society's sort of fallen on top of itself multiple times, you know, and again, each time it's, you know, you've got that whole cycle, right? Strong men create good times, breed, you know, weak men breed bad times breed strong men, which sort of the cycle repeats itself, kind of thing. And mm-hmm. you know, each, like, the cycle of, you know, good men building good times or breed, you know, creating strong times, is that, you know, capital is built, and capital is essentially just, you know, it's resources, it's production, it's you know, it's more efficient use of, you know, natural resources and time and energy and all that sort of stuff. So that sort of stuff gets built, and you know, in true capitalist form, you know, the product of that labor is, you know, essentially safe and stored for, you know, future allocation. And that's how we sort of compound, that's how we grow. And then inevitably you get, you know, these stupid, you know, younger generations or stupid generations who sort of grow up in some sort of, you know, level of prosperity where there's capital to then basically take, you know, or redistribute. And you have these, you know, bureaucratic leeches that sort of, that can't create anything themselves. They can't add to the total capital of society. So they go and try and take it, you know, from, you know, other people in society. And they sort of right. feed off that capital base. And that's sort of how they exist until there's no more capital base to feed off. And then the whole fucking thing falls on top of itself. Now, Bitcoin is arguably the first time we've got a form of capital that cannot be eroded or taken away from us by the leeches and by the idiots. Because, you know, I mean, it's fundamentally information. Now, you know, someone could have countered that and say, yeah, well, they can just lock your ass up if you don't want to give up the private key. But, you know, I guess Bitcoin allows for at least a decent degree of plausible deniability. And, you know, what it's also, it benefits, you know, almost, you know, it's inversely proportional. Bitcoin's price is inversely proportional to the collapse of, you know, all fiat money. To a large degree. So you've sort of got this, again, multi-dimensional transformation happening where those of us who do have a brain and who are sort of freedom oriented are actually going to get to hold on to our capital this time. You know, our farms, our lands, our stuff ain't going to be fucking burnt. You know, our gold's not going to be confiscated, or it'll be much harder to confiscate and, you know, expropriate our wealth. So that's number one.
Right.
But number two is, as Bitcoin sort of emerges as this economic powerhouse, because, you know, it's probably going to suck in money from all sorts of, you know, wealthy people who, you know, who now have skin in the game. It's going to be much harder to, you know, to delegitimize it, you know, as a place where value can be stored. You know, you're going to have this situation where, Bitcoiners are going to be quite wealthy, man. You know, we're going to have a shitload of money. And in the same way as, you know, the market sort of, you know, rises up, to supply meets demand, you know, products emerge when there's a need, where there's a problem, you know, where, you know, Bitcoiners are going to say, well, fuck, I don't want to live in a place where, you know, when I do work, you know, half my wealth is taken, or, I mean, you know, most probably tax rates around the world are going to, you know, inch up to 60, 70, 80% over the next few years, particularly after the fucking catastrophe we've had this year, and the erosion of global capital that we've had this year. You know, you're going to end up in a situation where, you know, a lot of wealthy people will want to band together, and you'll have these sort of failing states. Like, I mean, my parents are from Macedonia, and I was recently there, and mate, that is a fucking failed state. It's an ex-socialist, you know, place where nothing works. Any young person with energy and a brain runs the fuck out of that country as soon as they get an opportunity. You know, and whoever is left is basically, you know, lazy fucks, old people who've given up on life, or corrupt politicians who basically live off the ever eroding tax base, A, and B, whatever handouts they get from the EU. So those kind of jurisdictions that are basically failed states and banana republics are going to, you know, those bureaucrats are going to have nothing left to feed off because the carcass is finished, that, you know, Bitcoiners who have all the money are going to be able to come in and say, all right, we're going to buy this whole parcel of land here. You know, we'll hire our own private police, you know, our private defense. You know, we're going to have a treaty in place, but we're also going to have some defense. So if you try and fucking, you know, backflip on the treaty, we'll be ready to defend ourselves. We'll have opportunities to sort of build these cities or these jurisdictions that are sort of go beyond what was traditionally considered a nation state. So, now that will probably come in many flavors as well. You know, that it might happen, you know, from buying land from failed states. It may also happen in, you know, places that are traditionally, like, you know, more established. So, like, let's say some states in America that you know, might lose their shit over being run by, you know, some Marxist communists, you know, if Biden and Kamala sort of get in, or if Biden fucking kicks the bucket and Kamala, who's a well-known Marxist, sort of comes in and decides to turn America into complete fucking USSR, you know, some of those states might say, well, look, you know, we don't want to be a part of this shit anymore. So we might see some early secession, you know, we might, you know, that's probably also very likely in places like, Spain, where you've got, you know, different jurisdictions like Catalonia and things like that who might want to secede. I mean, the entire European Union, I think, is going to fucking fall apart this decade because it can't, you know, it can't maintain itself. So I think, you know, I kind of said it a week ago, was like, you know, Trump is an actual peaceful force of fragmentation and localization. He's actually moves us back in the direction of that in a way that's a little bit more conscious and peaceful. Whereas, you know, Biden and stuff getting in sort of move us towards the catastrophic path to decentralization and fragmentation, which is, you know, the thing getting so big that it falls under its own weight because it's bankrupt, you know, morally, economically, ethically speaking. So, you know, unfortunately, you know, if Trump does lose and it does turn out that, you know, the fraud can't be proved or whatever the case might be, you know, we're kind of going to end up there anyway. But it's just going to be an uglier path to get there. And, you know, I guess that path dependence will sort of dictate probably the sequence of the kind of private cities that emerge as a result of, you know, a bunch of wealthy people who no longer want to participate in these draconian societies, you know, as they look for a way to opt out. So I just think that that's, you know, that's realistically going to happen. And I mean, I know at this point in time, I'm definitely not wealthy enough for it, but you know, if, you know, Bitcoin sort of becomes worth 10, 20, 30, 50 million, you know, we'll be in a position to be able to do that. And I fucking very much look forward to that day.
Yeah. It's so exciting to think of these possibilities. And because when you look at all the things going on, it's kind of difficult not to get a little depressed or like just angry and fed up. But the reality is that with every failure, like every regression is just part of a process, right? So wherever there's great change, there's great opportunity. A truism, I guess, but I think it makes sense. And with cities, do you think that this is something that seems very far off, right? For someone who isn't necessarily involved in the Bitcoin world listening to this, they might think that maybe that's a possibility, but maybe like years and years down the line, like our system of government is so established and the public acknowledgement of what nation states are is so like set in stone right now. But is this something that could change drastically over the course of like a few years? Or
yeah,
I mean, we're talking, this is very, very broad, a very broad, yeah, sweeping question. But
I guess sweeping changes like that are mimetic in nature. So they're sort of like, you know, they take hold of society quite quickly, you know, they sweep through. And, you know, I mean, if we look at this year, like, you know, how quickly different memes spread through society, in a world that's, you know, far more interconnected. Now, granted, it was, you know, fueled by mainstream media and hysteria and social media and all that sort of stuff. But I mean, memes like, you know, wear a mask, but, you know, they fucking spread through like wildfire, you know, memes like flatten the curve.
Yeah. Like, I'm amazed. You know, I'm just baffled by this. Like, I'm in Chicago and everyone outside is wearing a mask. Walking the
Madness. Fucking stupidity.
Your dog.
But yeah.
Yeah.
The thing is, like, it doesn't take much for the meme to sort of reverse. And this is sort of the dynamic nature of life, is that, you know, everything is fundamentally temporary. You know, my biggest concern, and the reason I rail and rage against the machine, is that, you know, whilst I know that long term, like, you know, because A is A, whatever these idiots are doing, it's going to fail. Like, it's simple as that. Like, you know, statism and centralization, you know, is fragile, and it'll continue. Like, it'll get to a point where it just falls under its own weight. Like you cannot run things on a, you cannot run complex systems from a central point. You know, they fail, they fall on top of each other. The problem I have is like, what does that damage, that falling apart look like? And how long does the falling apart take? And what the fuck impact is it going to have on my life personally? Because, you know, I'm a individual who actually gives a shit about my own life, right? So I wonder if that means that we're going to have to go through 10 years of bullshit, or 10 years of hiding, or 10 years of, you know, sort of not saying that you're a fucking Bitcoiner. Like, I don't know what that looks like. So that's really where my railing, you know, comes down to, is that, you know, my biggest concern is like the impact of that fall. Like, will we prevail in the end? Yes, that's not an if, it's just a when. And it's just what does the intervening time look like? And that's sort of, you know, where all of my sort of concern rests, because, you know, reality catches up to you, but it's, you know, again, people can stay irrational, for a period of time. So it's how long until that meme sort of, you know, turns around, and the meme that, you know, Corona is a scam starts to permeate. Now, you know, there's multiple factors that drive that. You know, it's, you know, it's how many people, you know, personally affected, you know, either lost their job or, you know, have some sort of economic, you know, personal economic disaster, or, you know, have had a family member that they care about who was in their final years and they sort of died, or how many relationships break up, how many sort of, like, so at some point there'll be a breaking point where people just fucking finally flip out, and they sort of, you know, the meme sort of goes the opposite way. And, you know, the meme is, let's sue the fucking government for locking us down, you know, and that may happen, but it sort of needs voices behind it, needs credibility behind it, needs all that sort of stuff. And it takes a little while to pick up steam. But I think, you know, it always seems slow in the beginning, but when it hits a tipping point, you know, it sort of catches up. And then that's when the herd kind of comes in. And this is the natural way of things. You know, you're always a contrarian when you're early. And, you know, when the herd catches up, you're no longer a contrarian. Then you sort of like, you know, you benefit from the mass that comes after you. But it's kind of like the pendulum of the world. And the question really is, you know, do you want to be a contrarian that's sort of labeled as crazy and fucking insane in the beginning, and have the benefit of, you know, being ahead of the curve? Or do you want to be, you know, sort of with the safe majority and the sheep that sort of come in later and not really benefit from being ahead of the curve? And it's not really, you know, is one right or wrong. It's just, you know, what does your personality sort of incline you towards? And me, I'm a natural contrarian. I think most Bitcoiners are natural contrarians. So we'll sort of find our way naturally towards being, you know, being different. And this sort of, you know, ties back to
the first ones off the boat getting shot.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I hope that, you know, we don't get all shot in the process.
Right. So,
you know, I hope that the ones that, you know, get shot are like the Roger Ver's and the Eric Voorhees. But they've kind of shot themselves, the idiots. You know, coming back to your question is like, oh, you know, government seems so, you know, entrenched. And yes, that does seem to be the case, but slowly by slowly, all faith in the notion of government is fucking eroding, like really, 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 really eroding. And there's going to come a tipping point where that sort of starts to really, really disintegrate. And again, my guess is that it's going to start with cessation by, you know, I think that the place that's most likely to have fractionation and cessation is the European Union, because at least over there, you still got these sort of this notion of countries who are just going to sort of argue with each other. I mean, when the economic reality of this clusterfuck sort of comes out next year and the year after, when, you know, I think it's, you know, the figures of in like, you know, when you look at Greece and Spain and Portugal, of people who, you know, particularly, and those nations are all sort of driven by tourism, which is now dead. You know, they already have statistics where like young people are, you know, unemployed in the order of, you know, 40, 50, 60%. It's fucking ridiculous. So they're all going to Germany. Now, Germany is sort of like the powerhouse of Europe. So now you're going to have the situation where Germany is either going to call all the shots because they're sort of providing economic stability to the rest of the region. And then, you know, these other countries are going to have to face, you know, the Faustian bargain, which is, yeah, do we just sort of cuck up and, you know, become, you know, German states in effect? Or do we tell Germany to go get fucked and, you know, we sort of take our own destiny into our own hands? And you're going to have this sort of rise of that alternative opinion. And it's going to tear apart the European Union. And you know, that, again, it's going to be messy. You know, it's going to be ugly, but it's going to happen. And, you know, right. what the rational person needs to do is think about how to best navigate that. You know, step one is, you know, own some Bitcoin. Step two is, you know, have a backup location that you can go to during the mess. Step three is keep, you know, educating yourself. And at some point, you know, the incentives, like, you know, some of these, again, broke-ass states that decide to secede or whatever the case might be, you know, that they might even start selling things like, you know, their passports and stuff like that to, you know, to entice entrepreneurs to come in. You know, they might create free economic zones like sort of the Dubais of the world have created in the past so that people could come and build industry there, because they're going to, you know, the economic reality is going to hit them. They're going to fucking starve and they need people to come and produce, because you know, as much as we've been taught this economic fallacy that, you know, consumption is how we measure economic growth, it's consumption cannot come before production. And all these idiots who sort of, you know, put consumption before everything else are going to at one point have nothing to consume, and they're going to be begging for the producers to come back. And that's where, you know, these sorts of, these, you know, future projects of, you know, potentially private cities or free economic zones and things like that are going to emerge from. That they're going to be a need, not a luxury.
Right.
At least that's
so my guess. I think that makes a lot of sense. It's just so fascinating to be able to look at what's going on and have this. It's almost like we have a crystal ball, like that we can see vaguely how things will play out. We don't know the exact timing, obviously, or, you know, the exact details of everything that's going to happen. But once you understand certain aspects of how the world works, you're able to step from a higher view and see where things are going. Fascinating.
There's a famous saying, which is, show me your bank account and I'll describe your life. And what it basically, and I can't remember who said that, but it's like, what it means is that if I, you know, I don't need to hear a word of what you say. I just need to see where you spend your money, and I know what kind of life you're living. You know, talk is cheap. It's, you know, action is what defines a human being. You know, and the most important form of action that someone can have is where they put their money, right? So it's like, you know, your vote doesn't mean fucking jack shit. It's where you put your money that matters. And at the end of the day, like, the if you want to have a better understanding of the world, you want to just have an understanding of incentives and what direction those incentives will lead a particular behavior. Like, what behavior... Right. will emerge from a particular set of incentives. That's all you need to know. And from that understanding, you can paint a rough picture. It's not going to be exact. You're not a fucking Nostradamus or anything like that, but it's going to be quite directionally accurate when you understand the kind of behavior that will emerge from a set of incentives that, you know, that society or that, you know, a group or a community or a city or a country sits on. And so it's not fucking rocket science. And that's why, like, you know, I had discussion with people and they're like, oh, you're so arrogant. You think you know how everything's going to happen. I'm like, well, I don't know how it's going to happen, but I kind of know why it's going to happen. And when you know why, when you can understand the incentives and the behavior that emerges from those incentives, you can be pretty damn accurate on, you know, the medium to long-term sort of results. Like the short-term, is you can never predict the short term. The short term is always fucking noise. And that's, again, it's another one of the fallacies of of how the world works is like the media and social media and, you know, advertising and consumption, and everything is based on short term, which is all noise. No one can predict anything. No one can make a, you know, a rational decision on anything, because it's all just noise and chaos and fucking he said, she said, and like all this crap in the way. But if you sort of take a step out and you focus on, you know, principles, you can kind of get a feeling for, you know, directionality, which is far more important than anything else. So
right. Yeah,
I think it's an important concept for people to understand.
So do you think that, do you think we talked about the idea of private cities and entrepreneurs coming in, or wealthy people coming and buying failed nation states, or smaller, or, you know, portions of land in the future as things further unfold and, become dismantled. Do you think there's opportunity now for Bitcoiners, at least, I don't know, some Bitcoiners to, which I'm sure some are actually doing this. They're just not necessarily talking a lot about it, you know, for us to come together and build our own hideout, like build our own fort to kind of sit this thing out. A lot of us feel like there's things going on that we don't really want to take part in. And maybe there are parts of the world where we can kind of coalesce.
Look, it's a tough one. I think, you know, the next 5 years we'll see a lot of MVPs, I guess, for this concept of private cities kind of emerge. And whether that's little, you know, communities, whether that's, you know, I've spoken to Bitcoiners who sort of, you know, going off the grid, they're building their own little caravan so they can sort of, you know, get out of the way. You know, they're going to like Bali or, you know, Mexico or places like that, just sort of like to be out of the way, because, you know, so I don't know exactly what that looks like. I mean, there's people that are buying, you know, backup citizenships, you know, for like Caribbean countries and things like that. So all of that kind of stuff is already happening. And that's sort of like the MVP versions of what private cities, you know, will sort of take form from, later on down the track. But I just don't think, you know, the economic mass isn't there yet. Like, to really build private cities, you need multiple billionaires to come together. And that's going to require Bitcoin being at about $1 million. So, or at least $1 million, if not more. So I still think we're probably, you know, somewhere between 5 to 10 years away from, like, we're at least another halving, away from, you know, that becoming much more of a reality, in the early iteration of private cities. Like, that's, I would guess, like, you know, we'd probably see 2025, you know, after that halving, 2026, you know, because, I mean, this cycle, what, we'll probably hit like 200K US or 250K US Bitcoin, you know, maybe around that sort of region. And we'll probably have a correction. We'll have another few years of consolidation. And then, you know, the next FOMOing will probably send us to $1 million. And that'll sort of be post the next halving. Now, again, I don't know if that variance is again going to be, you know, an 80% down and then 1,000% up. But, you know, I think there's strong, you know, that there's this real reality that Bitcoin, you know, makes some real fucking moves, this decade, and makes a bunch of us extraordinarily wealthy, and, you know, put us in a position where we can go and become producers again. But keep our wealth instead of it being expropriated by some leeching middleman.
Amen. That, it's extremely heartening and encouraging to have this option. Like, I'm just so grateful to have found it when I did, and really grateful for, you know, guys like you who are out speaking about these ideas openly. And I think it takes a lot of courage to challenge these larger institutions, even though it's really just with words. I've kind of vacillated over that, wanting anonymity and wanting to kind of write it out in obscurity. But then there's also wanting to just speak the truth and wanting to get as many people around me to see what's going on.
It is encouraging, man. It is encouraging. Like, and it's good to have these conversations, because we do, like, when we're stuck sort of alone and we're surrounded by idiots, you know, we sort of think like, fuck, am I actually the crazy person? You know,
yeah.
you start to question your own sanity, right?
Right.
And then you sort of, you have these conversations, and I mean, that's why communication is such a powerful thing. Like, you know, and that's why encrypted communication is even more powerful, because those of us who think we're crazy, those of us who are rational, who are starting to believe we're crazy, we can actually have open conversations with people that are similar, that are around the world, and we can sort of come together. And, like, I mean, you know, I'll tell you what, like, the early citadels are like the Telegram groups. I know Parabolic Trav just put together a little group on Telegram, and it's going to be limited to like 100 people or something. And it's, I think his criteria was, you know, Bitcoin maximalist, pro Trump, and pro stock to flow model. So it's like, you know, and it's, you know, good little selection criteria. I think, you know, you have to be like, I mean, there's a lot of dumb pro Trump people, but Bitcoiners that are pro Trump are generally like, they've thought about why they're pro Trump, which is an interesting filter. You know, me for example, I was definitely pro Trump over Biden. I mean, I'm pro no government, but in the absence of, you know, in the absence of no government existing, Trump was definitely a force for localization and fragmentation, which I think is extremely important. So, but you know, so I guess the point there is that, these things are already emerging, and they're starting off as, you know, communication. And that's where the new ideas, that's where the future of, you know, citadels and free society is actually going to emerge from. Is going to emerge from these places where private communication can take place.
Right.
Yeah, really. You know, I just hope enough of us can fucking survive, and that we don't get jabbed by some vaccine or locked up, you know, in some thought, thought police prison camp for questioning why are you jabbing a vaccine into me? I'm already healthy. So that's right. Kind of my biggest concern.
Yeah, that seems to be kind of one of the next iterations that they, the powers that be, plan on implementing in this weird thing that's going on. Well, we'll have to, maybe we'll be able to crowdsource some kind of like cave city for the great escape from the vaccines, at least for the time being.
we'll need a cave city, and we'll need a hell of a lot of guns, man.
Because, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's what's good about the US, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's why, like, still, you know, despite all of its flaws, and despite the fact that it's been infected with, you know, with collectivism, you know, there's, you know, the fact that the forefathers were, you know, intelligent enough to, or, you know, they had the foresight to you know, have the Second Amendment in there, is like, man, the American forefathers were absolutely incredible human beings, and that Second Amendment is a fucking godsend, like, because no other society has that.
Yeah, it is. Although, you know, some people talk about, you know, the ability to resist the government, and it is like. It does have substance, like the Second Amendment, the fact that so many Americans own guns. But then I'll go and look up like U.S. military weaponry on YouTube, and you see these, you know, missile launchers that are able to launch like 20 missiles in like 10 seconds or something. And they're all like lined up, just obliterating some mountainside. And I don't know. There's an aspect of military might that the government has that I pray that there are generals, there are military forces that are sort of going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole as well. You know, it seems like that's kind of going to have to be part of it.
Yeah, I think it's hard. Like, I mean, you know, despite the military being a, you know, a state institution, I think, you know, to a large degree, you know, there's a lot of good people in the military with like good values, and for them to go around, you know, killing civilians, particularly the people that they're meant to be protecting, I think that's probably much more prevalent in police forces than it is in the military themselves. Now that doesn't mean, you know, nothing like that will ever happen. But yeah, I mean, you know, one of the dangers there is that, you know, when you move away from, you know, person to person combat and you just turn it into like a little drone strike, you know, you don't even need, you know, a military personnel to go in and, you know, kill the civilian. So that kind of, you know, desensitizes it. But I mean, at the same time, it's like, you know, a couple of atrocities like that will turn fucking everyone against that. And, you know, you'll end up having some sort of dissent internally anyway. So again, it's not a matter of, you know, does that kind of oppression last? Because it never does. That kind of oppression basically, you know, turns in on itself. It's parasitic in nature. The problem is, you know, the collateral damage or the casualties along the way. And, you know, you kind of, you know, whilst right. we want to be loud and we want to sort of, you know, make people, you know, or help people hear the appropriate message, like, you know, we don't want to be martyrs, but it's a really hard, you know, balance there. You know, it's like, how do you resist, but not become a martyr in the way, you know, along the way, mm-hmm. not become a sellout, you know, so you see, it's this balance between being a fucking sellout and a martyr. And, you know, where do you sit along that spectrum? It's again, mm-hmm. hard question to answer. I don't know the exact answer, I think. But definitely when you think about the gun laws, I would much rather have, you know, the right to bear arms than not. It may not be the perfect solution, but it is, you know, much better in the direction of a solution than not having the right to bear arms. So, you know, again, trade-offs, man. That's reality.
Definitely. Definitely. Alex, dude, thank you so much. This is a really awesome conversation. I want to be respectful for your time. And let you finish up that article. I'm looking forward to reading it. Is it going to be, you're going to post it on your Medium?
Yeah, it'll be on my Medium. Page. It's called Rest in Peace, America. Welcome, Bitcoin. So it's going to kind of be, it's a discussion about, you know, the death of the American dream, you know, how the land of the free has become the land of confusion. And I'm going to talk about, you know, how it's almost been, you know, partly the fault of, you know, or largely, sorry, the fault of America itself, that it's, you know, put itself in a position where it's collapsed. I don't know, I've got a good spin for the end. And yeah, I think it's going to be a really powerful article. So yeah, keep an eye out. Hopefully I'll get it posted in the next day or two. And I think it's going to be quite an important one.
That's awesome. Can I get, I just have one more question before before we sign off. I'm wondering this question, I read this question in Peter Thiel's book, The One Thing, is that what it was?
Zero to one.
It's what is something that you know to be true that no one else believes?
Well, my answer to that literally is Bitcoin. that question has been with me since I read his book, you know, 5-6 years ago or whatever it was. And you know, like, because Peter Thiel's always been someone I really, really, really respect. He's extremely intelligent. He's very, very, like, he's an extraordinary critical thinker. He's an absolute, mm-hmm. like, master strategist. So, like, I've got a lot of respect for that guy. So, for me, my ultimate answer to that question is literally Bitcoin. Like, that is the ultimate answer for me to that question, is that very few people... Like that is the ultimate contrarian bet. So like that's an easy one for me. And I haven't found a better answer to that. And I don't think we'll find a better answer to that for the next at least 5 to 10 decades.
Well, hopefully it becomes irrelevant because everyone else will believe it too.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. So that's why I think it's going to be the answer to that question. Maybe not 5 to 10 decades, maybe sooner. Maybe it'll be the answer to that question. It'll be the ultimate answer to that question for at least the next decade. And then mm-hmm. after that, the question might change to, you know, what's a, you know,
thing that you believe that nobody else does. It's that, you know, anarchy is the natural state. Maybe that's the fucking thing that moves next, because, you know, you have a state of, freedom, because, you know, anarchy is how the rest of nature and the world functions. You know, we're the only idiots who think we need to institutionalize and monopolize, you know, law and order, for example. So it's like, I think those kind of contrarian positions will emerge, but I think the ultimate contrarian position at the moment is definitely Bitcoin. That's probably a good way to sign this off.
That's great. Thanks so much, Alex. I appreciate your time, man. Look forward Absolutely. To talking to you again sometime if you'd be
Absolutely,
down.
Man. Yeah, 100%, man. Stay in touch. We'd love to chat in the new year, man.
All right, everyone. Thank you for listening in. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Alex as much as I did. It was an absolute pleasure for me to have him on. Alex has an extremely bright mind, and he is an extraordinary individual. His passion for freedom and for truth is truly infectious, and it affected me deeply in a positive way. So I hope you enjoyed it too. Be sure to follow Alex on Twitter at Alex Svetsky, and on a Medium as well to see his latest work. He does have a new article up. If you guys liked the show, feel free to hit the like button. And if you want to support it, you can do that by subscribing, leaving a review, and sharing it with any of your friends who you think would be interested. And also, if you're interested in checking out more or joining us for the event, the Interactive Deep Dive coming up December 12th and the 13th, you can do that at interactivedeepdive.com. Until next time, may you live a meaningful life and enjoy your freedom as a sovereign individual.